It's The Wonky Show. It's Reshuffle Week in Westminster, so we're reviewing who's up and who's down. There's a new OFS quality report out with big implications, and universities' financial sustainability is back in the news. It's all coming up.
Exactly. That's the first thing I think when I read these reports is, okay, how could that apply to us? If they came knocking on the door tomorrow, what would they say about our provision in these categories? And what would we have to be able to demonstrate value and quality in those areas?
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news policy analysis. I'm Wonky's editor-in-chief, Mark Leach, and joining me to shuffle the HE policy deck of cards this week are three fantastic guests as always. In Mile End, it's Chris Shelley, Director of Student Experience at Queen Mary University of London. Chris, your highlight of the week, please.
Oh, well, my highlight of the week with tongue firmly in cheek, Mark, has got to be the news that yet again there's a delay to the in-year returns for HESA data futures. But at least we got an apology this time from JISC, recognising the huge efforts that staff have put into the project for many years now. That might tell you more about how exciting my life is than my actual highlights there.
It definitely does. It definitely does. In Camden, it's Jess Lister, Associate Director for Education at Public First. Jess, your highlight of the week.
I started this week up in High Wycombe first time for Guild HE's conference, talking about public opinion and the public sector, which are my two favourite things.
Excellent. And live from Liverpool, it's James Coe, Wonky's Associate Editor. James, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight of the week this week is that for regular listeners, you'll know my daughter Olive is getting bigger every day, and this week she did a little bit of walking for the first time.
Right, we start the week with the big reshuffle in Westminster. Chris, what's going on?
Yeah, what a Monday we had. The day after, Sir Ella Braverman and James Cleverly laid a wreath together at the Cenotaph, watched on by Rishi Sunak and, of course, all the former prime ministers, including David Cameron. We awoke to find that Cameron had now become Lord Cameron in order to allow him to take on Cleverly's former role in the Foreign Secretary, and as he'd moved over to take over from Sir Ella. A reshuffle ensued, and many roles were changed throughout the day, either through resignation or otherwise, depending on whether you believe the resignation letters. A few of note for us, in housing, Rachel McLean was replaced by Lee Rowley. In DfE, there was another guess who's back moment, but the headlines were possibly dropped, which was Damien Hines returning to fill presumably the school's remit that's been vacated by Nick Gibb, who'd been there for many years. But for HE, the biggest note is probably the departure of George Freeman as science minister from DSIT. He'd held responsibility for research and arm's length bodies such as UKRI and ARIA, and he said that it was time to move on, and actually his resignation had been agreed back in September, and he's been replaced by Andrew Griffith, who's been in the Treasury for the last year. So an interesting time for us ahead. I guess another interesting note for the sector will be what James Cleverly's approach to international student policy will be. But maybe the biggest question is just, you know, will anything change, given it's likely to only be a 12-month or so cabinet?
Good, good. Right. Okay, so we'll come back to science. Jess, just tell us on a sort of meta level, is this reshuffle a kind of slightly friendlier flavour for the sector?
Yeah, so it's probably, I mean, I don't say this out loud, it's probably Rishi Sunak's last reshuffle before the election. So, you know, barring further crisis and catastrophe, which very well could happen, this is the team and the cabinet that he's now going to put in place to go into the election. It's a lot more centre-right than right-ish. If you look at sort of voting history and the people in the cabinet, you've had a few people that have been sort of up and coming for a while who are now around the cabinet table. So sort of following Claire Catino, who's now the Energy Secretary, we've got Laura Trott and Victoria Atkins, who are all seen as sort of Rishi's people. Laura Trott, is worth saying, used to be the education special advisor under Cameron. So it feels very Cameroonian as a cabinet. In terms of what it means for the sector, I'm not sure anything materially changes. We didn't have big changes in DfE. We've had a bit of a reshuffle of science minister, but you know, nothing. There's not really a reform.
What about the culture wars? What about the culture wars? I mean,
what about the culture wars?
Braverman is the, you know, the sort of the woke finder in chief, but we've got a new one of those, haven't we?
Yes. The thing I haven't mentioned, because I keep trying to forget that it has happened, is Esther McVeigh is back in the cabinet as the sort of czar on woke. So she is, you know, now probably one of the most right-wing members of cabinet, and basically has a brief to point at things that Labour does and say that it is woke. Yeah. You know, this is where the risk factor has always been for the sector. It's where it will continue to be. There is now someone dedicated to pointing out the things they do that the Conservative government disagrees with and that the people that vote for the Conservative government disagree with in the sector. And I just expect that is just going to get louder and louder over the next 12 months.
And possibly more hilarious and more desperate.
Yes, possibly.
James, so we've got a new science minister. George is a free man, finally. What's his legacy?
Oh, I mean, I've wrote a piece on this up on the blog, and I think Freeman's legacy is going to be remembered in two ways. So for Freeman enthusiasts, there is a legacy of, you know, ARIA, negotiating, getting back into Horizon where others wouldn't. And I think being seen as somebody who was generally positive and liked the sector a lot. I also forget he'd been there for absolutely ages. He'd done science roles for the best part of 10 years. He'd seen David Cameron start, leave and come back again in the whole time that he's been there. On the other hand, he is being, you know, fortunate to be minister when he was. There has been the record uptake in public funding for R&D, and he has done an awful lot of stuff that is yet to coalesce into a coherent agenda for science, and it all feels a bit vague and messy at times. So I think a friend of the sector, but probably some lost opportunities given how good the circumstances were to be the science minister.
Mm. And what about his replacement?
Andrew Griffith.
That's the badger.
Yes. So, Andrew Griffith, to be honest, Mark, I knew absolutely nothing about him until I started doing research when he got elected into the job. He's part of the 2019 intake, but his background is working in finance for likes of Sky and PwC, etc. He has done a few junior roles working across things like net zero and infrastructure and that type of work. I suspect based on the little bits we've seen him talk about science and the economy, that he's going to be a very different type of minister to Freeman. And I think it could be different in two ways. Having been former cities minister, I think he could do some more of the work, as in his terms he calls it, unleashing capital around science. Doing things like pension reform, spin-outs, the investment ecosystem, foreign direct investment, etc. On the other hand, given Michelle Donlan's recent speeches about woke science, and we should remember that Griffith is not only a friend of Boris Johnson briefly lived in his house, there could be a bit of a return to that type of agenda. So I think it is all to play for, but we should expect a different approach to Freeman.
When you say he lived in his house, you mean he crashed on a sofa on one of the many times he was thrown out by, you know, one of his previous wives?
He was living there. So he was living there, grace and favour, during one of the campaigns. He was a big friend of Johnson. And sort of, if you read the likes of City AM, one of the anger of the Tories is basically a suggestion that Griffith is only in his job because he helped finance Johnson's campaign.
I think Dominic Cummings would call him an SW1 NPC, wouldn't he?
I think you'd call everybody that. But, I mean, he's like...
I'm not from SW1.
On the other hand, I mean, nor am I. But on the other hand, I think he is, like, it is interesting to have someone who's like, we need more cash in the economy to do more stuff as a proper free marketeer in science. Mm. When basically the whole science approach has been, you put public investment in places to make them better. I don't know if those two things are necessarily reconcilable.
Well, not in a year anyway. Jess, go for Jess.
And the other thing, I guess, is having someone come out with a sort of treasury and business background means the first thing they look at is the science budget has gone up and where is my return on investment? And as you know, science policy fans will know that return on investment takes a long time and isn't immediate. You don't put money in and take money out quickly. You put money in, you let it develop into kind of brilliant science and innovation, and then it grows the economy. So there is a bit of a risk that having gone from a fairly enthusiastic natural cheerleader for the sector under Freeman, we now have sort of treasury scepticism and business mindedness sort of with the science funding brief, which up to this point has done fairly well compared to other sort of policy areas.
Yes, I think you're right. And I was struck when I was reading through some of his speeches on the National Security Investment Bill. He was talking about actually which country should we work with and in what circumstances. And one of the things he said was that the salaries of nurses and doctors and teachers depend on the cyclotron of capitalism that combines our world-leading science and intellectual capital with human talent from all over the world. So there is a bit of a thing of actually, you know, is in the way that we think you invest in the public sort of sphere, then private investment follows. That would suggest he almost has the opposite view of the world, that private investment crowds in the public sector.
Good. Or not so good, depending on your ideologies. Chris, back to David Cameron. You mentioned, I mean, my basic theory about this is that he's probably less likely to start wars with other countries, and stick with me here, that's good for universities, because stable geopolitical environment is kind of what we need to be able to recruit international students, you know, do all the international research collaboration, and all the rest. Plus, you know, we don't like war. So that is, you know, is it a slightly more slightly more stability, possibly a good thing?
Yeah, I mean, stability's got to be good. If we could have it for 5 minutes, it would be nice. And I know today that he's already gone off to Ukraine, and presumably will be spending a lot of his time out of the country and you know, warming the hands of leaders in other countries, because, you know, the gravitas that he has as a former PM and in relationships that he presumably still maintains from his time as a prime minister will actually potentially mean that he does have that extra level of influence as a foreign secretary than perhaps some of his predecessors would have. So I guess, yeah, that's what we can hope, is that he can, you know, be influential in his role, in his new role, in a variety of countries to minimise things such as war. But it remains to be seen.
And Jess, if we think back to his time as Prime Minister, I mean, a lot's been written about his sort of lack of engagement on the detail of these things. But he wasn't overtly hostile to international students, was he?
No, and the thing I'm really fascinated to watch is what the approach is going to be on China. So there's this 2016 sort of picture that's resurfaced over the last few days of Cameron and Xi Jinping, sort of Chinese premier, you know, having a pint in a Buckinghamshire pub. I think it's fair to say that China policy has hardened fairly significantly since.
So just to interrupt, but there's a great Twitter account called Insane Moments in British Politics, which is regularly retweets that one. But anyway, sorry, carry on.
Yeah, it's a real moment. If you're not very political, you really don't know what's going on there. Yeah. But China policy is something that, you know, the Conservative Party has become significantly more hawkish on since the kind of Cameron golden era. With Cameron back in that post, it's unclear to me what that means for some of these sort of legacy issues that the Conservatives have moved away from in the last 13 years or hardened lines on, to then sort of go back and have the sort of leader of those lines in place as Foreign Secretary. China's always been a really tricky point for the sector to talk about. Potentially, this is a really good thing because it means there's someone that really understands the sort of tensions and the complexities of that issue, rather than sort of reducing it to, you know, UK good, China bad. But with Labour being fairly hard line on China as well, I think that's one to watch.
I don't know if you saw in The Guardian yesterday, reporting that Chinese state media had welcomed the return of Cameron, which I think in the way you say it, Jess, will undoubtedly raise the heckles of some members of the Conservative Party.
Yeah, but he is, as Jess said, he's unlikely to kind of reverse the sort of current mood and policy, isn't he? Because this is, you know, the kind of the China hawks have essentially won the argument inside the Conservative Party, and he, you know, you assume anyway, he's not going to have the capital to kind of walk back to 2016, which was also, that was largely driven by George Osborne, wasn't it, as well?
I mean,
this was I would think so, but I suppose one of the areas, you know, if we speak to universities often, this strategic ambiguity about actually what on earth is the relationship meant to be with China. I think if this just means there is even less clarity about how they're meant to deal with, you know, one of our significant and largest trading partners, then that wouldn't be ideal either.
It depends on, you know, if you're from a negotiating point of view, it could be a good thing. You know, the sort of keep it shrouded in mystery.
I suspect we won't sort of get there. We'll just see Cameron bop around the world, shaking hands with foreign dignitaries, while Rishi Sunak sort of stays at home with his spreadsheets for the next 12 months. So maybe I'm being optimistic, thinking we're going to have sort of coherent foreign policy rather than just photo ops.
Well, it's probably better than some of the alternatives, which I guess is why he was put in the House of Lords for this reason. Right, I'm searching for more of your reshuffle hot takes before we move on. And what else have you got for me?
Only other thing is this sort of very quiet resignation of quite a few like mid-level ministers. George Freeman is one of these. But there seemed to have been a whole gang just sort of desperately waiting for a reshuffle so they could go back to their constituencies and spend a nice time with their family. So we've had Will Quince, Neil O'Brien, Jesse Norman, Jeremy Quinn all sort of disappear. There is this sense that there are a lot of MPs just waiting to resign. And I think, you know, they've been told not to announce it, so it doesn't sort of further sink this idea of a Conservative Party in just total decline. And we've had quite a lot of experience just vanish very quietly and go sit back home for 12 months, which again isn't a super sort of positive thing for good governance.
The only other thing I know, of course, now is following, you know, last night's breaking news, is of course Labour will now have to reshuffle their front bench. Given a series of resignations. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out and how they line up against this new cabinet.
Let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
My name's Matthew Guest. I'm at Durham University, and I've spent the last 2 years working with colleagues at the University of Coventry on a project that's concerned with how students build relationships with those who are different during their time as students in higher education. We've studied the whole of the UK higher education sector, taking case studies of universities that are institutionally very different from one another to look at the different ways in which they cope with diversity within the student population. But also we've surveyed students at two different time points with a 12-month period in between in order to ascertain patterns in the way in which students across the UK view religious and worldview difference, but also the way in which those attitudes change between those two points in time. What we've found is that students do develop a strong positive orientation to difference over that period, so that universities do, as is often assumed, help equip students to relate better to those who are different from themselves.
Right, a big new report out from the UFS on quality. Jess, walk us through it, please.
So we've had three more quality assessment reports come out from the UFS. So these are the sort of Ofsted-style boots-on-the-ground investigations that were launched looking primarily at undergraduate business courses. So this time round, we've had ones for BPP and Goldsmiths, which found no concerns, similar to the previous reports from University of East London and LSBU. And one with some concerns, as this is the University of Bedfordshire. So there's three areas that the OFS have picked up as sort of points to raise. One's around appropriate styles for teaching delivery. So for Bedfordshire's non-traditional students, it seemed that the way that teaching was being delivered wasn't working for them, and Bedfordshire wasn't being responsive enough to that. There was one around student engagement and the personal tutor system, which didn't seem to be working well at all. And there's one around a sort of institutional strategic response to low continuation. So just a real lack of understanding about why continuation rates were low and what to do about it. Like with the previous reports, there's no regulatory decision. It's just a sort of report on the investigation. And I know on the site today, there's some rare praise for the OFS from Wonky's own Jim Dickinson, who thinks this is some of the best work the OFS has produced, with a list of polite suggestions on how to make it better, obviously. But it seems like the OFS has really sort of picked up some momentum in this sort of, I think, fairly new style of investigation and reporting, with a whole new bunch to wade through today.
Right, there's a lot there. Chris, I mean, it's not easy running an institution like Bedfordshire, is it?
No, absolutely. I mean, it's not really easy running any institution, especially no. Post-COVID. And when we're talking about, you know, teaching delivery and the specifically the timetabling point there, while it is a good and perfectly understandable statement to say that, look, your teaching delivery has to reflect your student body. And this reference to non-traditional students needing a different model designed for them. The student bodies at places like Bedfordshire and Queen Mary and many, many others are so diverse. You know, to simply bracket them as traditional and non-traditional is actually a lie in itself. So, while it's positive to see an encouragement that we should be looking at flexible ways of delivering the curriculum to meet the needs of a diverse student body, that in itself opens a huge can of worms. And if you look at what's happened since COVID, obviously everything moved online temporarily. Very quickly, when we were allowed to teach back face to face, we were under a lot of pressure to make sure that we did so, and there was pressure on universities to not be seen to be cutting corners or lessening the student experience or not giving students value for money by leaving things online. And that would fundamentally change the mode of delivery. And actually now, we are all learning that there are benefits to blended styles of delivery. There are benefits to a mixed mode of education, but they will be applicable to very different students and very different disciplines in very different ways. Pointing out that an old style face-to-face timetable, potentially asking students to come onto campus and off campus again 5 days a week, is not necessarily ideal. Is a perfectly fair point, but it does put an awful lot of pressure on the university and the rest of us in the sector to read that and think, okay, well, what does this mean? Especially given it's not regulatory, what does this mean for expectations around our teaching delivery, our teaching mode moving forward? You know, we're looking at ourselves, looking at our curriculum design, looking at different options for delivering a range of qualifications, especially in the sort of lifelong education context. But if there is now pressure from the OFS to deliver your timetable in a range of ways to suit the range of needs of a very diverse student body, that's a very big piece of work.
Right, James, Chris gets to the heart of the matter, doesn't he? Because it's this diverse student population, it's the financial pressures on a university like Bedfordshire that has massive historic disadvantages and less money to spend per student than the bulk of, certainly the average university. So is there a risk that kind of these kind of things get, start to get into a kind of a doom spiral?
Yes. And I think the Office for Students argument would be that every student, regardless of where they learn, regardless of what they're learning, deserve a certain set of baseline standards. But our interventions are context dependent on the type of institution that we are visiting, regulating, whatever you may choose to call it. I think where the rubber hits the road is probably twofold. On the one hand, you can say that actually we have an access regime, we have a sort of overall regulatory approach, which is about flexibility in different times of learning. And then simultaneously, whatever the regulatory intervention looks like can't be too punitive, because then it's saying, actually, well, that discourages people from doing interesting things. So I think in general, I would say that the Office for Students intervening, where they see pockets of practice that they deem to be poor, that they've got advice for improvements and the sector can learn from it, is good. I think what the regulatory intervention looks like, if there is one, or whatever that chooses to be, is going to be really, really tricky to get the right turn.
Right, yeah, that's right. And we're still waiting to find out what the actual intervention is going to be. We've just got this report, haven't we? So, go on.
No, so it could be nothing. It could be just, it could be very, very light to say, we spotted this, can you make it better? But we know that the OFS has a whole range of powers to intervene in things like this.
Yeah, Jess, Bedfordshire has been the kind of bête noire of right-wing newspapers and conservative politicians for a number of years, with that famous Daily Mail headline calling it the worst university in Britain, which is just kind of completely overblown and doesn't look or feel like that when you when you're inside it and working to support the students there and deliver great teaching and all the rest of it. But do you think they should feel rightly aggrieved that they've been singled out here? And in this context where, there have been certain figures, powering that narrative over the last several years, briefing the newspapers, getting ministers to say things out loud. And, is this just sort of, could this be viewed as kind of another chapter of that, that movement?
So what I can't get my head around, and I'll confess this is a sort of area of higher education I know less about than others, is why it was very specifically undergraduate provision for business courses that got singled out in the first place. And then a bunch of providers, it seemed, were selected to go and be investigated because in different ways they weren't hitting certain metrics. So with sort of continuation and completion, I think being the main ones, but also sort of graduate outcomes and these other sort of soft signals the OFS like alludes to of, student complaints and things it hears and sort of sector warning noises. I think what's really interesting about this is that of all the reports that have come back so far, only two have found concerns, which feels significant, but the concerns listed feel very much like things institutions could move to address and things they just need to improve, rather than kind of really existential moments of very, very low quality in the sector. And so I'm not sure, I think it'd be really interesting to see what happens next from the OFS, from having identified a really fairly specific pocket of poor provision. investigated a bunch of providers, found some very institutional specific failings, which can only really be solved at an institutional level. There doesn't seem to be many sort of regulatory levers that can be pulled to fix some of these problems. What are the actual conclusions and actions that these institutions now take? And is it actually, you know, these investigations happened last year. Is it that these are things that can be fixed in 12 months and you know, these reports are just sort of a sort of stain on the record? Or are we looking at sort of system-wide failings? It feels very much like the first. And therefore, sort of every time a report is produced and, you know, four people gather on a podcast to talk about it, I don't know if it feels a little bit disproportionate. I think I would feel a bit aggrieved if I was in Bedfordshire almost, partly because of this conversation.
Chris, do you take a report like this and, you know, can it be useful to you? Can you look at this and go, well, right, if they're going to come for us, now we know what they're looking for, because they haven't really published much in a way of kind of what the criteria is. So you can go through these concerns and say, you know, make sure we get our house in order before, you know, we suffer the same fate.
Exactly. That's the first thing I think when I read these reports is, okay, how could that apply to us? If they came knocking on the door tomorrow, what would they say about our provision in these categories? And what would we have to be able to demonstrate value and quality in those areas? The worry, I guess, is that, you know, as more and more reports come out, if one in four reports finds three or four things to pick on, the rest of the sector will be compiling a pretty long list of things that we need to now go and check ourselves. And of course, without being party to that particular investigation or knowing exactly what's going on the ground in those specific points, we might be looking to address something that doesn't need addressing, or we might be addressing it in the wrong way. And that's the concern. You know, if you're Bedfordshire, then presumably you're very much mindful now, okay, in our next TEF submission, we clearly need to reference this investigation and have acted on it, because while it's not regulatory, those pointers are there for a reason. If for the rest of us, it's difficult to be too specific about referencing things that have gone on in other institutions, but it does give us a very clear steer on the sort of things that they will be looking for, whether or not they investigate us, but certainly in terms of high quality provision. And I think there's some meaningful points in there. To say that a university needs to understand the reasons for non-continuation and completion, he's absolutely valid. And I don't know what Bedfordshire's evidence was in the process they went through, but that's definitely a really useful pointer for us to make sure that we are properly engaging with our students to understand what it is that's causing the non-continuation, reaching out to those that haven't continued to find out really why, and try and address it, you know, evidence-based, putting evidence-based interventions in place rather than just guessing and assuming and perhaps pointing to external factors that are nothing to do with us. So there's definitely things we can learn.
I think that's interesting. So on its own terms, getting pointers from, you know, visits and things like that is obviously helpful for your own practice. But I presume not what isn't helpful if there ends up being such a literature about every intervention ever, they end up forever tacking in the wind of maybe we should be thinking about this, maybe we should be thinking about this. And it makes me wonder, back to Jess's question, whether it's strategic enough to help you reflect and say, and actually, I can see the direction that things are going in.
Now, DK's here to tell us about a big week for data futures fans.
Hello, so David Kernahan here, and if your office is anywhere near the people who deal with student records, you'll be hearing a lot of screams of despair in recent days. This is because, once again, the Data Futures programme, led by the Office for Students and delivered by JISC on their behalf, has once again been facing problems. We've seen over previous weeks that the way in which data is collected and is validated by the collection software has not worked. It's been throwing all kinds of errors and generally upsetting people left, right and centre. This particularly has annoyed the Office for Students to the extent that they're going to hold a full inquiry into the programme of work on which they have spent several million pounds of funds over an incredible 7 years of work. If you're thinking to yourself, okay, this is just a way of counting students, how hard can it be? There's numerous exceptions and rules linked to the collection that cause all kinds of problems if it's not returning error messages correctly. The upshot of this is that we're expecting the quality of data this year to be quite low, and the plans for in-year collection of data next year, which was the entire point, after all, of Data Futures, is now not going ahead. This is pending this full inquiry, which is clearly going to be a concern for JISC. So what happens next? We're not really sure. It certainly means more disruption and more panic for a community of student record officers who have already dealt with a lot of problems. It means a knockback to timetables for everything from NSS data collection to HSIS data collection. And it just makes OFS and JISC not look great in the eyes of the sector or in the eyes of DfE. So hopefully this is something that can be fixed and pulled together fairly soon.
Now, sector finances are back in the news. James, walk us through it.
Mark, there is a problem with university finances. Sure. So let's take a step back. Universities are funded largely by students. Hub students, as we know, are worth less in financial terms every year because of inflation, more fees don't go up. And that means that the incentive is to chase uncapped fees, often international students. So that means if I'm a university that wants to get bigger, my best route to growth is to recruit more students. However, at an event at Guild HE this week, Office for Students Director Regulation Philippa Pickford said that there was an optimism bias in many providers' financial returns. And one of the examples she gave was about future growth in student numbers. So, alongside other concerns around things like changing to the teacher's pension scheme and some news reports we've seen of universities who may be in financial trouble, it seems like we are hitting a bit of an autumn of discontent when it comes to university finances.
Right, yes. So, and Jesse, the VC at King's, Shishir Kapoor, called it the triangle of sadness that universities are stuck in. I mean, that's not news, is it, for the sector?
No, and I'm not maybe not the biggest fan of shape metaphors, but I think it's an important point that you have a system where, as lots of our research has found, you know, students feel massively sort of overburdened by the cost and sort of debt associated with higher education. And their sort of parents and supporters and everyone looking at the system worries about student how much debt students take on to go, but the amount that they pay doesn't actually cover the fees. So you've had sad students, sad university sort of finance office is, and then also sort of this ongoing issue around research funding not quite being sufficient, staff being unhappy about their pay. We've seen lots of industrial action this year, ongoing sort of seemingly resolved for a bit, but maybe not resolved in a long term issue around pensions. I think I've now got five sides. Maybe now it's trying sort of pentagon of sadness. But it feels to me like we're just waiting for an institution to fall over, which is an awful sort of policy position to be in. Of, you know, all of these warning signs have been talked about at length, you know, by us at Wonky, by people in government, by sort of people watching the sector. But no one is quite clear about what specifically needs to happen to make sure that a university isn't going to sort of go bankrupt in the next 2 years. And as potentially we're now just in a world of sort of, you know, the bit in the KCL report that really got me was 100 of 144 universities reported a financial deficit. You know, it's not that there are, you know, 10 or 15 institutions that are struggling. It's like every institution is struggling. And we're just waiting to see, like, which one collapses first, at which point someone will do something. It does feel a bit like an existential crisis to me.
Yeah, so one of the things that was interesting in Shishij's article was him highlighting that, you know, institutions are trying to do multiple things and ultimately regulated by one body. And actually, he gave the example of California being a state with the same sort of size as UK in terms of GDP and similar number of world-leading universities. And they have a different system. They have research universities regulated by one body. They have teaching universities. And then they have community colleges that serve sort of the economies as well as individuals. And you know, by having different regulatory bodies and different funding models, they're much more sustainable. But I mean, that sounds like an interesting model to look at, and it certainly would be an interesting direction to move in. But in order to get there, you would think that there would be an awful lot of victims in the UK sector. Presumably, many institutions would start separating themselves up into different entities, but there would also be new providers coming onto the scene. And ultimately, there wouldn't be enough space for all of us. And that would, you know, come back to the point about the optimism of student numbers that Philippa Pickford comes reference. So yes, it's not a new problem, but some interesting new arguments perhaps presented in the week. And just to come on the pensions point, I guess the teaching pension scheme has been in the news because of its challenges. But on the flip side, the USS is about to reduce its contributions from both employers and employees. That may be a relatively short-term thing in the grand scheme of things, but that in actual fact will be a financial benefit to institutions who are in the USS. So, a fluctuating landscape as usual.
James, I'm fascinated by this optimism bias and sort of a bit alarmed by it, really, because I mean, surely running a university over the last several years, you might have noticed the tremendous ups and downs and that the sector has been through for all sorts of various reasons. And thinking about, for example, international students this year, which everyone is saying that it is really down, really, really, really down on last year. This is possibly the end of the big boom. And decisions might have been made on all sorts of different, all sorts of different spending decisions might have been made on the back of, projected numbers that there's never any guarantee that it's gonna come through, is it? And I mean, this is no way to plan and run a sector.
I think the alternative is, however, if you choose not to be optimistic and you choose not to believe that there's going to be continual student growth, then the alternative is horrendous, right? Because the reason to be optimistic is that, as far as I'm aware, a public institution has never gone bust. So there is that sort of ultimate optimism that's not going to happen. But if you choose not to be optimistic, well, then that is to choose that the entire higher education system doesn't work. If we are going to assume that there's no increase in fees, well, then the only route to increasing income is increasing student numbers. It's not like providers can simply change who they are or what they do. So I suppose I get the optimism bias, but what else do universities choose to do? You can choose to radically downsize, but that has its implications. You can choose to cut staff or cut, programs, but that isn't great either. So although, Philippa calls it optimism, I also think it is a realism about the shortfalls of the sector that actually being optimistic about student growth is the only strategy in lots of ways.
It's a really clever bit of analysis from the Office for Students, though, I think, that, I'm fascinated to see the numbers behind it, which is where they've, I think what they've done from Philippa's comments is looked at, across the board, everyone's planned future growth in student numbers and gone, well, that actually isn't possible if you take the sector as a whole. So who's getting it wrong? My worry is we're about to see quite vividly who's getting it wrong, because we're going to have institutions that just sort of slowly start collapsing. We've all, as Mark said, the sort of murmurs this year that, recruitment is slower than usual, particularly international student recruitment has sort of slowed down a bit. The line has always been that the sort of current funding settlement could last for a bit longer, but not much longer. And maybe 2024 is the year that it sort of all falls in on itself a little bit.
I think on that, Jess, if you think about the regulatory landscape, well, then the two options are that either, we get back to a place where we are controlling demand really tightly.
Yeah.
And, we're saying controlling supply really tightly, rather. That you can say we can only have so many students in so many institutions in order to make the sector function. Or what I think the sector would rather see is a much more wide-ranging, review increase of the unit of resource. Capping numbers is much easier of those two options, albeit I think is impalatable for other reasons.
Chris, let's try and think about this another way. Does it matter if an institution is running a deficit if it isn't going to collapse anytime soon? There's a long tail, isn't there, between those universities that are kind of running a deficit all the way down to ones that, we worry about as a going concern. Is there a risk sometimes that we lose sight of, the broader, public duty that a university has to teach people, to give them a great experience and all the rest? It doesn't, if the government is not giving us a kind of sustainable funding settlement, then university finances aren't going to be sustainable. There is obviously an end point to that, but assuming that something gives in the next 15 years, most institutions aren't about to collapse, are they?
No, I think that's probably right, but that's a bit more of a fundamental case for the point of higher education, and the challenge that we've always got is the image and the perception that universities are essentially, in inverted commas, publicly funded, and partly funded by students directly. That therefore the expectation that we're not losing money is not necessarily as much about, oh no, that means you're going to go bust in 5 years, but mm. more about, are you being fiscally responsible with other people's money, and explaining the kind of nuance and the point of higher education, and trying to explain to the wider public that, look, you know, we're in this situation largely not of our own making, and actually we'll be okay. It's probably not likely to wash, and certainly some of the media wouldn't let us get away with that, I don't think. But yeah, I think in reality, we will get through it and we'll get by. And the thing about the student number targets and saying, well, you know, the growth exceeds the number of humans that are likely to be in the cycle is undoubtedly true. But that also doesn't mean that if everyone doesn't hit their targets, we're going to fail. You know, universities set targets, but they also have scenarios where if we only hit 80% of that student number this year, or 60% or 40%, then we reduce spending in other areas and in other ways. So not hitting your targets doesn't suddenly mean, oh no, now we're going bankrupt, unless you've been very fiscally responsible and started spending money that you absolutely haven't got until it doesn't appear. Mm.
Readers of Wonky aren't likely to accuse us of having an optimism bias over in this side of the world. But in terms of your prediction that 2024 might be the tipping point, something will give in some sort of bad way sometime next year. Some undefined bad way that is probably going to be bad for at least one university, certainly going to be bad for the sector as a whole, possibly leads to some existential questions. I'm just your sense of where government is on this. So surely a failure of any kind of public institution is more evidence of kind of a broken state, right? You can't get the trains, you can't get a GP appointment, nothing works. Now universities are collapsed. This isn't a good news story that a government, of any stripe can say, look, we're cracking down on poor quality of degrees, and look what happens. This is a bad news story for whoever's in power, right?
Yeah, and there's parallels here to whenever we've had a sort of low quality Mickey Mouse debate, we should close a bunch of universities. You go, okay, and which ones would you like to close, Minister? And they can't pick because, surprise, surprise, universities are actually quite important to the sort of local people and places that they are in, even if they aren't sort of traditional Russell Group universities, which sort of capture the imagination of politicians. I think one of the wider issues here is I don't know if the sector is being strategic enough about some of the trade-offs on the route to a sort of slightly more financially stable future. Mm. There's a bit in the KCLP paper, for example, that hints a bit at this on the research funding side. So one of the kind of added pressures is that research isn't funded to the sort of full economic cost, and universities have to sort of add a bit on top of every sort of government research grant that they get. The trade-off for that, though, is less research, because there isn't more money. So if you are going to start to fully fund research, you are going to overall fund fewer research projects. And similarly on students, if we're in a world in which we're going to start to look at increasing the unit of resource, I don't know if we're going to increase the unit of resource for everyone. So what are the like high cost subjects, high demand subjects, sort of economically, socially, sort of useful subjects that you can start with? And then you get into a place of well, actually, that might still not solve all the problems for all the places. And, you're still going to have some institutions, even in those two scenarios, that are struggling, because not every university does research, not every university does sort of high-cost STEM. And I'm just not sure yet that any of the answers I have seen, and I should say that we haven't come up with anything better, sort of look at the scale and size of the problem in light of the sort of economic public sector finances, which don't look like they're getting any better anytime soon.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to dig a bit deeper into anything we discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can get the latest show automatically when it's out. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And to find out about how we can keep you and where you work ahead of everything that's going on in UKG, do head to the site and click subscriptions. So, thanks very much to Jess, Chris, James and Michael who makes the show happen. We'll be back next week. Jim will be here. Until then, stay wonky.